Welcome to American Variety Radio. I'm your host, Court Lewis. You know, a lot of our listening audience on American Variety are in Florida, particularly Central and East Coast Florida, so they tend to be more aware of the Atlantic Ocean than the Gulf of Mexico. I grew up right on the Atlantic coast, fishing and surfing all the time, practically every day, and I thought of the west coast of Florida as almost another state, and being a surfer, I knew more about the Pacific coast of California than I knew about the Gulf. I think for most Americans outside Florida, the Gulf is even less well-known. Probably two things in recent years have brought it into sharper focus. Hurricane Katrina in 2005 and the BP oil spill in 2010, two epic disasters, of course. But there's so much more to the Gulf, and that's kind of the underlying premise of a big book about the Gulf published in 2017 by a history professor at the University of Florida named Jack Davis, that it's the little understood, almost unknown sea that has had a tremendous influence in shaping the America we know. The book is titled The Gulf, The Making of an American Sea. It's a big nonfiction book in the tradition of James Michener, and in April 2018, it won the Pulitzer Prize. Professor Jack Davis is my guest today. Welcome, Jack.
Pleasure to be here.
Great to have you on. As I mentioned, this is a big book. I mean, we're talking 530 pages, not counting about 50 pages of notes and index. Well, I'll ask you kind of a semi-rude-sounding question. What possessed you to think of a book so compendious, such a tour de force, might even be publishable, much less a bestseller like it is?
Well, my previous book is a biography of Marjorie Stoneman Douglas, was 200 pages longer than this one. So from my perspective, this is a shorter. I was, my contract with my publisher gave me a word limit, and I pretty much met that word limit. It translated into these 500 and some odd pages. But I was also hoping that I would write the book in a way that it didn't seem so daunting to the reader, that it would read nicely and they'd move along through the book fairly quickly and yet cover, you know, comprehensive ground for them.
Well, you did all that and you hit the ball out of the park, obviously. So the book is divided into four parts, kind of like a four-act play. I'm going to run through them very quickly and then we'll talk about them. The first part is about the basic geography of the Gulf and the Native Americans who lived there and the Spanish explorers who first ventured into it. Part two is about the mostly wealthy Americans, generally from up north, who then discovered, quote, the Gulf Coast and its waters as a playground in the 19th century. Then, at that time, the beginning of the exploitation of its wildlife for fishing and other uses that we'll get into. And then part three is about the discovery of the beach itself as a playground, which, oddly enough, was pretty much ignored until around the beginning of the 20th century. Then, arguably, even more momentous discovery in part three, as it's described, which is the discovery of oil. So part four then picks up with the post-World War II era of rapid coastal development and the population growth and all the changes, economic and environmental, that came with it. So, my gosh, Jack, we could talk about the book and the Gulf for an hour, heck, for a day or more, I think, but let's take it one part at a time and just cover some of the main themes. Tell us a little bit about part one and the Native Americans who lived there and so on.
I think you described it nicely, at least the scope of that part. Indeed, the book covers the period from geological formation to the present. I stopped writing in approximately around summer 2016. And the first part was to introduce the physicality of the Gulf of Mexico, its geography, as well as its birth, of course. The first people to live along the Gulf Coast. And, people have lived along the Gulf anywhere from 8,000 to 10,000 years, really depending on, you know, the anthropologist or archaeologist who's doing the counting, and have lived on the Gulf since then in many different environments. There was one time, 1,000 years ago, when the Gulf shores were not the warm, sunny place that we know of today. It was cold. It was windswept. The humans had to share the land with megafauna, mastodons, saber-toothed cats, giant ground sloths, and giant armadillos. Not the kind we see on the roadside dead these days, but much larger armadillos. When the seas were shrunken, when the Gulf shoreline was anywhere from 60, 70, 80 miles farther out than where the modern-day shoreline is today. And in that section, I look at how those early people, those pre-European contact people, interacted with the Gulf environment, the natural environment of the Gulf of Mexico. That's what, you know, the book is really about. It's a history of the human relationship with the natural world of the Gulf, the natural characteristics. So as you describe the parts of the book, I organized the chapters in the book around natural characteristics, estuaries, beaches, fish, birds, barrier islands, rivers, weather, and oil.
Let's go back to the basic geography for just a minute. When you think about it, the Gulf is a funny word. It's like we talk about the gulf between, you know, two schools of thought or something. So it means like a gap. But what's the difference between an ocean and a sea and a gulf and a bay? I mean, those are all terms for large bodies of water. Is there a real clear distinction?
There is not a clear distinction. Basically, it goes by, you differentiate them by size, but that's not a hard and fast rule because oceans are typically the largest, seas next, gulfs third, and then you move into bays and bayous and sounds and so forth. There are a number of seas that are smaller than the Gulf of Mexico. The Gulf of Mexico is the largest gulf on the planet. And sea, but sea is also a generic term. You can use it to refer to any saltwater body. And the Gulf is often referred to as a sea. The Spanish called it the Spanish Sea, as a matter of fact. But a gulf generally is a semi-enclosed large body of water that has access to a larger body of water, and in the case of the Gulf of Mexico, that is the Atlantic Ocean. But then the Mediterranean, which is larger than the Gulf of Mexico, it's called a sea, and it's very similar in shape and form as a gulf with its limited access to a semi-enclosed nature and limited access to also to the Atlantic Ocean.
Because I was thinking about the Sea of Cortez and the Sea of Galilee and the Red Sea and the Dead Sea, and I think they're all a lot smaller, but that kind of explains it then. So it's sort of a squishy term, and kind of whoever names it first, maybe, I don't know. But how is the Gulf formed? I mean, here it is, this big, more or less round body of water surrounded by land masses for the most part, except on kind of the southeast side. So how is it formed geographically, just kind of in a nutshell?
So let me dispel one myth, and this I encounter in the many public talks I give. The Gulf was not formed by a giant meteor strike. It is actually, the Gulf was older than the Atlantic Ocean, and it formed through the process of rifting of the supercontinent, the Pangaea. So as Pangaea began to split up, what we call now the Yucatan Peninsula moved away from what we now call the Florida Peninsula, and open up this gulf that eventually filled in with water and created the sea that we know of today.
So it's kind of like the Atlantic, the way it's formed really from the separation of North America from Africa and Europe, I guess, and South America from Africa. The tectonic plates split over eons and eons and allowed water to fill in and became oceans. And in this case, I guess it's a different process, but similar for the Gulf.
Very similar, yes. Different process, slightly earlier process, but the same idea.
So the Gulf is not, you know, again, reading your book, the Gulf is not a big stagnant bathtub. It has what are called loop currents within it. And oddly enough for me, you know, again, being a surfer and a fisherman from originally the east coast of Florida, the Gulf Stream parallels the coast of Florida on the Atlantic side. And I always thought of it as an Atlantic current that was coming up from somewhere in the south. And I never thought about the word gulf there. Comes out of the gulf, doesn't it? So kind of briefly describe the currents and how they coalesced to form the Gulf Stream.
It does come out of the gulf. And I think a lot of people fail to make that connection between the Gulf Stream and the Gulf of Mexico, again, where it originates. So you have currents moving up from the Caribbean through the Yucatan Channel and that form these loop currents that run around the perimeter of the gulf. They eventually loop around from west to east, come down the Florida Gulf Coast and make their way, these currents make their way out of the Florida Channel and between Cuba and Key West. And form this tremendous ocean current, which is like a river and a current, which pushes, as I note in the book, pushes more water than and all the rivers on Earth combined. And that's pretty remarkable, as a matter of fact. And I misspoke. It doesn't come out through the Florida Channel. It comes out through the Florida Straits.
And if you've ever been offshore, off the eastern Florida coast, and or even up into the Carolinas, really, but the further up you go, the further out the Gulf Stream is. But if you've ever come to the Gulf Stream, it's astonishing what a clear demarcation there is. It is like a river, almost like a river in a bank, in a way. It's like there's a 10 or 20 foot kind of demarcation line where you can clearly see the difference. It's really pretty amazing, really, that it holds its character in the middle of the ocean like that. So we talked, Jack, a little while ago. We just mentioned briefly the Native Americans that lived along the Gulf. Just what was life like? We've got so much to cover in this half hour. Gosh, I wish, you know, as I said, we could do this for at least an hour. But what was life like for the Colusas and other Gulf tribes back before contact with the ever-friendly Europeans?
Well, they lived in a close relationship with the natural environment and the marine environment in particular, the estuarine environment. The Gulf of Mexico is one of the richest estuarine environments in the world. There's some 200 estuaries around the Gulf of Mexico. The indigenous peoples took advantage of these estuaries. The Colusa, for instance, in southwest Florida, who you mentioned, were sedentary people. They were not nomadic. They stayed in one place. But they did not have agriculture, and that was highly unusual for sedentary people not to grow crops. But the Colusas didn't need to. They took 95% of their protein from the estuaries of southwest Florida. It came to them. They didn't have to pull up stakes and move seasonally to follow the food like other hunter-gatherers did, because the food came to them. And it was very similar with other indigenous groups around the Gulf of Mexico. Although most of the rest tended to be nomadic, they would spend the winters on the Gulf of Mexico because they were always assured of food there, whether it was oyster or crabs and fish. And then during the spring and summer months, they would move inland to gather fruits and nuts, but also to hunt land animals.
Yeah, so for those who weren't forced to be nomadic, it was kind of edged toward the idea of paradise because, as you said, the food came to them and they didn't have to go hunting it. They just kind of fished and netted and, you know, they dove and came up with their food pretty easily compared to many other native tribes. So how many people, I mean, going all around the Gulf, which takes in a lot of different tribes, how many people were they? Do we know what the total population was?
We're uncertain. You know, the estimated number of people living in the New World is constantly changing. You know, right now the best guess is probably 400,000, but somebody could come along, some scientists could come along tomorrow and say, no, there were many more, or no, there were many less. But right now that is the best estimation of some 400,000 people.
No, it's a good number of people for the, 10,000 years ago or whatever, 8,000. So I mentioned the Europeans. I guess it was in the 1500s when the first Spanish explorers came. How did their encounters with the first Spaniards go?
Well, what's interesting and what I really love about this part of the history is that the Gulf natives tended to know about the Spanish before the Spanish knew about those who lived on the Gulf shores. And when Juan Ponce de Leon arrived in Florida in 1513, both on the East Coast and on the Gulf Coast, in the Port Charlotte area in southwest Florida, he encountered a native person who spoke some Spanish words. These were seafaring people who lived along the Gulf Coast. They just didn't stick to their immediate areas. The Florida natives were known to paddle and sail to the Bahamas and the Yucatan and Cuba. So word got around that the Spanish or that these strange people from faraway lands had arrived in the Caribbean, and they were doing tremendous destruction to the Caribbean, particularly to the Indians there. They were dying left and right. They were being enslaved and overworked and infected by European diseases. And right. So by the time the Spanish arrived in the Gulf Coast, the Indians knew about this, and they fought them off. They were staunchly resistant to European intrusion. Most of them were.
Yeah, it's kind of like the aliens have invaded. You are listening to American Variety Radio. I'm your host, Court Lewis. We're talking with Jack Davis, who's a professor of environmental history at the University of Florida, who's written a Pulitzer Prize-winning book, nonfiction book, called The Gulf, The Making of an American Sea. We're kind of working our way through this very compendious and big book, rich in detail. Turning to part two, Jack, in the 19th century, two things, I think fishing and fashion, basically, drove an awakening interest in the Gulf. Why don't you talk about these two aspects of what caused the Gulf to suddenly become more in focus for Americans in general?
Well, as far as fishing, we have both commercial and sport fishing. Very interesting histories that I learned as I was researching and writing this book. The Spanish occupied the Gulf of Mexico for over 300 years. The French came along, the British came along. But none of the three really developed a viable commercial fishing industry. The Spanish, not so ever. The British didn't spend enough time on the Gulf of Mexico to develop it. And so it was really the Americans were responsible for the birth of commercial fishing on the Gulf Coast. And it was not Gulfsiders, it was New Englanders. Of course, New England is where the commercial fishing in America was all but invented, right? They're fishing out their grounds pretty early. And so in the first decades of the 19th century, New Englanders start coming down to the Gulf of Mexico to fish and sell their catch in New Orleans and Havana and Mobile, and then return to the northern waters in the summertime. They're the original snowbirds, if you will. Mm-hmm. But it was also fish that was responsible for the beginning of the tourist industry in the Gulf. We might think that it was beaches, but no, it was not. It was this wonderful fighting fish, the tarpon, that everybody wanted to, in the sport fishing world, wanted to catch but didn't quite know how to until 1885, when a New York architect by the name of William Halsey Wood hooked the first tarpon. And it set the sport fishing world on fire. This was in 1885, and people from the Midwest, from the Northeast, from the British Isles converged on both the Florida and Texas Gulf Coast. And it would take 3 days from New York just to get down to Southwest Florida. Men and women came together, and catching a tarpon, this wonderful fighting fish with these tremendous acrobatics and that would fight you for a half an hour or longer, was like, as I write in the book, it was like going deep sea fishing without having to go out to the deep sea, because in the springtime, the tarpon come into the estuaries to feed. And these were 150, 200 pound fish. And that's really the beginning of Gulf tourism. Eventually, these sport fishers who came down to Texas and Florida discovered the wonderful beaches and started coming for the beaches as well as fishing, and then eventually for the beaches alone.
You know, personal reminiscence here. I had caught, when I was a teenager, a couple of small tarpon in little estuary areas off away from the coast, 10 pounds or less or whatever. But once I was fishing on the end of a jetty, very calm, flat day, nothing biting, and I was using 8-pound test line on a small rig, and I was standing on rocks on a jetty by myself and fishing with a topwater lure that kind of dove a little bit. And all of a sudden, I hooked, basically to make this short, about a 7-foot-long tarpon, I would say a good 200-pound tarpon, leapt up out of the water about 6 feet and took off, and he just kept jumping and jumping and jumping. And I had 200 yards of line on the reel, and I stood there like spellbound going zzz, 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 and watching this basically Poseidon missile take off every 3 or 4 seconds out of the water until he popped my line. And I just stood there with the rod in my hand. I was stunned, an unbelievable sight. They call him the Silver King, and on a sunny day like that, the sun just shines on them like silver. I mean, it's brighter than the moon on a dark night. You know, it's really amazing to see. And so I can see what captivated sport fishermen back then about the tarpon. But there was another thing that, although that wasn't much good for the tarpon, because they caught and killed them and hung them up and took pictures of them and so on. But there was another thing that was more disastrous from a wildlife standpoint, which was the plume trade. Why don't you talk briefly about that?
Yeah, around the same time in the late 19th century, most popular hats in fashion in London and Paris and New York were feathered hats for women. That ignited this very lucrative and busy trade in hunting bird feathers. And the most desirable birds tended to be the stick-legged wading birds of the coastal areas, herons and egrets and white ibis and flamingos when they lived in Florida. And many others. The nuptial feathers or the plume feathers of the snowy egret were worth as much as gold. Not surprisingly, there were commercial hunters that combed the globe going after these feathers. And the Gulf Coast and Florida in particular were very popular areas for feather hunters. And they ended up devastating the bird populations, wiping out whole rookeries that might have a population of several thousand 10, 20, even 30,000, they could wipe them out in a couple of days. So in many places, the wading bird population declined by some 90%. But the upside to the slaughter of birds was the launching of the conservation movement to save these birds.
Yeah, well, that was an expensive start because, as you say, they darn near wiped out all of the plume bird population along the entire Gulf. Luckily, it stopped in time, right? So those birds have bounced back. Well, so now we come to what I guess we could call the beginning of the modern era of the Gulf's history at the start of the 20th century, and that would be part three of your book. How did interest in the beach as a destination finally start, and why wasn't it an attraction before? You'd think it would have been, but it wasn't.
Well, the beach was not originally an attraction because people were not very comfortable around the shoreline. You know, the Apostle Matthew said, the man who builds his house on the shore or on the beach is a fool. And, you know, the shoreline was historically regarded as this dangerous place where storms would blow in, where invaders would come ashore. And so people were more interested, those who were interested in water, were more interested in spending their time on backcountry lakes and rivers. But by the late 19th century, people began discarding those fears in the north first. In the New York, New Jersey area before the South. But again, as I mentioned earlier, it was tarpon fishing that introduced people to the beautiful beaches of the Gulf Coast. It's hard to find whiter beaches, fluffier sand than you find along the Florida coast. And that sand, by the way, is quartz sand that originated or came from the Appalachian Mountains, which were as high as the Himalayan Mountains at one time. But over the eons, glaciers and rain and ice and wind eventually moved that quartz mineral down to the Gulf Coast and built its beaches and its barrier islands, by the way. So it was really at the turn of the 20th century that beach tourism started to take off.
It's interesting. I didn't know that sand had come from there. I assumed it came up from the erosion of reefs offshore and things like that. So that's interesting to know. All right. Well, let's turn to the other big boom and bust, in a way, the plague and the scourge of at the same time as the great benefit of the Gulf Coast. When and where was oil first discovered on the coast?
Well, oil was discovered first in Texas, not offshore, but just a few miles inland, and in the Houston Beaumont area, and in the early 20th century. And in other places around the United States, there had been so-called overwater oil drilling in lakes and just a few feet off the shore in Santa Barbara, California. But when they discovered oil in the Gulf Coast or along the Gulf Coast in the early 20th century, they began to realize that there was a connection between salt domes and oil. So wherever there was this salt dome beneath the surface, there was a pretty good guess that you would find oil as well. And eventually, geologists discovered there are some 500 salt domes around the Gulf of Mexico, both inland and offshore. So the first overwater oil wells were drilled into bays and bayous around Texas and Louisiana in the early 20th century. But the first out-of-sight-of-land oil well was sunk off the coast of Louisiana in 1947. And in researching the book, I found a direct connection between the actor Jimmy Stewart and that out of sight of land oil well, 1947. He was not a partner in the drilling of it. His connection came in some other way. And if the listeners want to know what that connection is, I'm sorry, they'll have to read the book.
The book again is The Gulf, The Making of an American Sea. So, boy, Jack, we have to hurry along much faster than I'd like to, but let's turn to part four. And I'll say that in South Florida, on the Atlantic coast, servicemen from all over the country in training during World War II got their first look at palm trees and sun and sand and year-round warm weather and decided to come back to live when the war was over. So what drove growth on the Gulf Coast after World War II? Was it the same thing?
Yes. Well, you essentially named it. Initially, it's these millions and millions of servicemen and women who came to Florida during the war. There were some 172 installations, military installations in Florida alone, not to mention the rest of the Gulf Coast. And many of these people liked what they saw and decided to return after the war immediately or after they retired. But what facilitates that rush to Florida is the residential air conditioning, which really comes of age in the post-war period, as well as mosquito control, initially thanks to DDT,
right,
which we know is extremely harmful to the environment now. But the combination of those three things really launched a population boom in Florida in the 1950s that continued into the 1960s. Then followed by Disney World, which opened in 1971 and brought even more people to Florida and initiated a second population boom in Florida. So to give you an example, in 1950, there are some 1.5 million people living in the state of Florida. In 1970, some 7.5 million. By the end of the century, over 17 million.
Yeah, it's been, Florida's just a story of boom and bust in construction in the tourism industry. But after every bust, the boom is even bigger, and the influx of people is always tremendous. I think on average, over a period of decades, since World War II, it's been something like 5,000 to 8,000 people a day moving into Florida. Well, we can't leave this, and I hate to leave it at all, but we can't without talking about the BP oil spill in 2010, possibly the worst man-made ecological disaster in history. I still sometimes wear a T-shirt that says, Save Our Gulf. It's kind of getting faded now, but how about the Gulf? Is it faded? How has the Gulf fared nearly 10 years later, just in a nutshell?
Well, let me start by saying that the BP oil spill is not the worst environmental disaster that the Gulf of Mexico has suffered, not by far. The greatest environmental disaster is daily. It's what comes into the inland waters from rivers and from onshore facilities. What's more destructive to the Gulf is not those oil wells offshore, and I'm not advocating oil wells offshore, but it's the inshore infrastructure that is needed to support the offshore facilities. There are some 10,000 miles of oil industry canals running, slicing up the Louisiana coast. It's marvelous coastal marshes, which are unequaled in the United States, probably the greatest estuary on the Gulf Coast, but they are causing tremendous erosion in that area. What comes down the rivers, again, is fouls the waters, whether it's industrial waste or human waste or agricultural runoff. So it's those sorts of things that have been very destructive, more destructive than an oil spill, and then again on a daily basis. There are a lot of people around the Gulf Coast who work very hard to keep it revitalized, to protect it, to rebuild, to replenish and restore those harmed estuarine environments. And they've done a tremendous job of keeping the Gulf safe and restoring it. As far as the BP oil spill and its impact, you know, the jury's still out. We don't know. We don't know what will happen with the next big storm, what it might stir up. There's still tar balls washing up on some shores.
So given that, ongoing, continuous ecological disaster you described from the rivers, if you can answer this briefly, and it's hard to answer briefly, I realize, but what's the outlook for the Gulf in the next 50 years? Will it turn into a stagnant bathtub, or will it pretty much stay status quo?
I have hope for the future of the Gulf because of good people around the Gulf of Mexico, volunteers, conservation groups, smart policymakers. We've brought the Gulf back from worse conditions than it is in now, and I think we can do so again.
Jack Davis, we're going to have to leave it there. I hate to do it, but we can certainly lead people to your book, The Gulf, The Making of an American Sea, a Pulitzer Prize-winning book. It's fascinating, chock full of every kind of information about the things we've been talking very superficially about here. You can buy it at all the usual places, Amazon and any bookstore. Jack, thank you again for being on with us on American Variety.
I very much enjoyed it.
And thanks to all of you for listening. I hope you'll tune in again next week, same time, same place, for more American Variety Radio.